Thanks very much. So I would like to start by thanking the organizers for putting together what's promising to be a wonderful conference and for inviting me to give the opening talk. Well, so both entanglement and holography are individually absolutely amazing topics. So trying to give an overview of entanglement in holography in just 45 minutes seems rather too ambitious. And so instead, I'll aim to give you a somewhat impressionistic account of some of the intriguing aspects in the subject. So I'll be neither comprehensive, nor pedagogical, nor anything other than ruthlessly minimalistic with the references, but I hope to give the non-holographers at least a pictorial anchor for some of the other talks. So I'll start with, before getting to holography, I'll say a few words about entanglement, which everyone in this audience is quite familiar with. So entanglement is not just an essential feature of any quantum system, but it's arguably the most non-classical manifestation of quantum mechanics. Mathematically, entanglement is present when the global state of a composite system cannot be expressed as a product of the individual states of the subsystems. And this curious feature that the best possible knowledge of a whole does not include the best possible knowledge of its parts has perplexed people since the early days of quantum mechanics, and in fact lies behind the most pressing paradoxes even today. But the more modern viewpoint on entanglement is as a new quantum resource for tasks that can't be performed using just classical resources. And that feature has propelled entanglement into the forefront of quantum computing and quantum information, but also recently has percolated as wide-ranging fields as quantum many-body systems and quantum field theory. And the aspect that I find most intriguing is that there have been hints of profound connections to geometry. So a nice way to characterize or quantify amount of entanglement is by entanglement entropy. So suppose you have access only to some subsystem of the full system, let's call it A, and the entanglement entropy of that subsystem is then defined by as a von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix corresponding to this subsystem. So you first trace out the part that you don't see, and then you take the von Neumann entropy. So this is well defined if you can divide the system in such a way that the Hilbert space is factorized. So how you divide up the space, of course, depends on what systems you have. And suppose if you had just a spin chain or something like that, you might isolate a couple of spins that you have you can observe. But what we'll be interested in this talk is a field theory, a local field theory, a specific class of field theories, where it's most natural to separate out a spatial region as your subsystem and trace out the rest of it. Okay, so the region that we'll be interested in is separated from the rest by what we'll call the entangling surface. It's some smooth separation. And we'll be most interested in sort of trying to describe entanglement entropy of such a subregion in a local quantum field theory. Now, entanglement itself is, and especially entanglement entropy, have been very useful across many areas, and this conference will bring all that to fore, so I'm not going to sort of try giving an overview of all that. But because it's sort of so sensitive to the detailed quantum nature, quantum correlations, it's very hard to deal with. Okay, it's very sensitive, it's very complex, it has complex structure, and it's very intricate and sensitive to environment, it's quite difficult to measure. And of course, it's notoriously hard to calculate for anything but the sort of simplest systems and toy models. And this is especially exacerbated when you have a strongly coupled system. But over the years, we have been getting used to the expectation that whenever you have a strongly coupled field theory, and some perplexing question in a strongly coupled field theory, that ADS-CFT, holography, comes to the rescue. All right, so we have been led to expect that indeed we can use holography to answer that question, at least in an analogous class of systems which we can access. So you might ask, well, okay, so entanglement entropy is very interesting quantity. It's very hard to calculate. So can we use holography to try to make progress? And so the question is there some, well, what I'll call the bulk jewel, I'll explain this in a moment, of this entanglement entropy, what we would call the holographic entanglement entropy? And the answer is a resounding yes, and what's more, it's described very simply. It's described geometrically. So to explain how that happens and why it feels like somewhat of a miracle, I'll go now to introduce some small subset of the key ideas of holography, the ADS-CFT correspondence. Then I'll tell you about the prescription for finding the entanglement entropy in this holographic setting. And then I'll try to spend most of the talk on explaining why this sort of geometrization is immensely useful. All right, so ADS-CFT correspondence, which most of you have certainly heard about, is a physical equivalence between two very different theories. String theory, which among others is a theory of gravity, is dual to, physically equivalent to, a gauge theory, a non-gravitational field theory, conformal field theory. The two theories live in different spaces. The string theory lives in the bulk of asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime. Okay, this is a maximally symmetric, negatively curved spacetime times some compact manifold. Whereas the gauge theory is living on just the boundary of this anti-de Sitter spacetime. Okay, so this was proposed by Maldacena in 97, and since then has had resounding utility and success. But in the early days, people like to visualize this in a cartoon of a soup can. So since I'm back at KITP, I can't resist just reminiscing on that. So you can think of the bulk string theory as being the soup, whereas the CFT is just the label. But you know, unlike an ordinary soup can where the label just tells you roughly what's inside, here it really is everything. So the key aspects of the ADS-CFT duality is that it maps a gravitational theory into a non-gravitational one, which is very useful if you want to sort of try to understand quantum gravity by recasting it in this non-gravitational language. And it's what we call holographic. Not that it has anything to do with real holograms, but it's holographic in the sense of adhering to the so-called holographic principle, where you describe a theory living in higher dimensions in terms of a theory, a lower dimensional theory. In fact, I think a better analogy would have been a stereogram, like this picture, where you see, it's one of these things, if you stare at long enough, you see a three-dimensional image coming out. So here it's just due to the correlations between the pairs of these splotches that your eyes interpret as parallax. But in the real ADS-CFT, of course, it would be infinitely more complicated with correlations between everything and the image, the CFT image, giving you a sensible picture, but quite different from the emergent higher dimensional gravitational picture. Okay, so the best studied example of the ADS-CFT correspondence is when you take a certain type of string theory on a five-dimensional anti-de-Sitter spacetime across a five-sphere, and in that case, the gauge theory is the maximally supersymmetric Supriang-Mills theory living in four dimensions, in three plus one, three spatial and one time dimensions. And in this case, the parameters describing the theories are, well, you have a string coupling, and you have the size of this anti-de-Sitter space, or the sphere, they're the same, in string units on the gravity side. And in the field theory, you have the rank of the gauge group, and you have the Hoof coupling. So there's a relation between these parameters. And so this is the relation between them, these guys and these guys. So you can see that if you want to have to suppress the stringy corrections, you want the size of ADS and the sphere to be much bigger than the string scale, you need to take a large proof coupling, so strongly coupled field theory. And moreover, if you want to suppress the quantum corrections, you want to, in addition, take the rank of the gauge group to be even larger. Okay, so in this talk, we'll be working solely in this limit where you have a strongly coupled field theory with very high rank of the gauge group, so very large central charge, and we'll be describing it by a dual classical gravity on ADS across a compact manifold. Okay, so apart from having a gravitational theory mapping into a non-gravitational one and this holographic aspect, it's also a strong weak coupling duality. Okay, which means that when we can calculate here, it's hard to calculate here and vice versa. But that has an advantage that we can now use gravity on this side to understand strongly coupled gauge theory. And this is often sort of the best, or even in some context, only tool to understand this side. And conversely, we can use the gauge theory to learn about quantum gravity in ADS. And of course, this has had enormous success over the years. And I think we have just seen the tip of the iceberg on this, okay, despite all the resounding success. But the prerequisite for sort of pushing this further is, of course, to understand the dictionary between the two sides very well. And much of the dictionary, well, part of the dictionary, at least the beginning of the dictionary, you can read off already from the sort of geometry. All right, so this is a cartoon that many of you, that, well, at least the non-holographers might have seen most often of a patch of ADS, so-called Poincaré ADS. I actually don't really like this very much. It's supposed to represent the field theory living on the boundary and the bulk, and this weird shape is supposed to sort of reflect the fact that you have the scales change as you go in, you have a non-trivial metric. But, you know, if you really wanted to draw this properly, this should be, you know, zero size, and this should be flaring out infinitely. So instead of using this cartoon, I'll just use a couple of different cartoons, okay? One, if I want to be talking about this Poincaré patch of ADS, I'll just have the boundary sort of as a plane up, and then the bulk going down, so this radial direction will be going down. But this actually is just a part of the geometry. You can reach infinite z in finite time, and you can merely, if you're a bulk observer, you can merely leave the space-time. Okay, so if you want to globally extend ADS, then this is the global, this is the full space-time. All right, for those of you who are not comfortable about metrics, don't worry about, you can safely ignore this. This is just for, for those of you who know what these things are, and just to sketch what coordinates I'm using. Okay, so if you just look at a spatial part of this global ADS, a nice representation of it is in this Poincaré disk picture, where you have the radial coordinate going outward. The boundary is this boundary, this black circle, and sort of these coordinates here are sketched like this, okay? And a better picture where I include the time direction is the Supkin-like picture of global ADS, where this Poincaré patch is just this this wedge between two null planes, okay, time runs up. This Poincaré disk is like looking at the soup can from top. So here I have drawn space-like geodesics, which are these green curves. The null geodesics, so light goes by, are and projected are these blue curves. And time-like geodesics, well, slosh back and forth because ADS is like has this attractive potential, acts like a confining box. So a time like if you let a particle from rest, it will sort of slosh around like this. Okay, so that's the cartoon of ADS that I'll be using most often. All right, and so now let's go back to this dictionary between ADS and CFT. And of course, the most obvious question you might ask when you encounter a holographic duality is to ask, what mocks up in the lower dimensional theory, what is it that mocks up the extra directions of the higher dimensional theory? So in ADS-CFT, a rough answer to this that at least holds, you know, near the boundaries, roughly speaking, that the radial bulk direction corresponds to a scale in the field theory. So this goes by the name of scale radius or UVIR duality. So initially, Susskind and Witten formulated it as the sort of regulator, a UV regulator in the CFT corresponds to large radius, so IR in that sense, in ADS. So here, if we have the boundary, and you try to describe some excitation in the bulk at some distance z, you sort of describe it by something on a scale given by that bulk radial position. And that sort of follows from the pure ADS geometry, from the structure of it. So if you rescale distances in the bulk in the boundary, that corresponds to moving this in the bulk. All right. So if you want to describe in global ADS in this Poincaré disk, if you want to describe a point in the bulk, all right, then you expect, roughly speaking, that it's given by you need the knowledge in the field theory that's spanned by this arc. But what I like about this picture, so this is one of these Escher drawings, that's nice representation of Poincaré disk where, you know, each of these fish is a constant proper size. So what I like about this drawing is that you can very easily see that these arcs are not unique. You can, for example, take this one or any of the other ones. And this is actually closely related to sort of encoding of the bulk as a sort of error-correcting code in terms of the field theory that some of you in the audience have developed, and that has been much of subject of lively debate in the other program, in the quantum gravity program. Now, it also provides, the scale radius duality provides a nice intuition of what you expect should happen. So, for example, if you throw some object from the boundary, and suppose you even have a black hole, so that would modify the inside structure here. In the bulk, the object just falls into the black hole. In the boundary, where you don't have any black holes, you don't have gravity, the local excitation, which corresponds to something at the boundary, just spreads out and eventually thermalizes. So this is, you can see this very nicely from this already, this cartoon. And you can also motivate that, for example, if you want to read off how local expectation values of various operators behave, that's encoded in the asymptotic fall of corresponding fields in the bulk. All right, so that's one aspect of the dictionary. Another aspect of the dictionary is that different geometries in the bulk that are still asymptotically anti-de-Sitter correspond to different states in the field theory. So if you have just pure ADS, as I have been showing you, then that corresponds to a vacuum of the field theory. And if you deform, if you excite the state a little bit, you put in some energy into the system, then the geometry gets excited and deforms away from this pure ADS, and you can read off the deformations from this stress tensor on the boundary. Now, if you have a large deformation. Suppose you take the field theory and you excite it a lot and it thermalizes, where in the bulk, you have some generic high-energy excitation. What will happen? Well, it will collapse to a black hole. That's just because you have gravity and you have this confining potential. Everything wants to collapse, so it will collapse to form a black hole. And so the black hole corresponds to a thermal state in the field theory. And the larger the black hole, the higher the corresponding temperature of the thermal state in the CFT. And you can also deform this. You can put in some time dependence. You can ripple this up. And, you know, if you, at the linearized level, if you kick the black hole, it will ring in the so-called quasi-normal modes and settle back down to the equilibrium situation that corresponds simply to thermalization in the field theory. And you can study the sort of the horizon response properties. If you kick the black hole, how those correspond to the transport coefficients in the CFT. And you can do this also at the nonlinear level if you have sufficiently slow variations in time and space by what's called this fluid gravity correspondence and so forth. So there's a lot that you can do in the time-dependent situations as well. But let me now go to the subject of this talk, which is the entanglement entropy. All right, so, well, there have been actually, within ADS-CFT, there have been two different paths, roughly speaking, that people have been following, or programs, I should say. One is what I would sort of characterize it as applied ADS-CFT, where you sort of want to study a specific system or class of systems on one side by using its dual, because you can calculate in its dual more easily. Another one, the other sort of program that people have been pushing is more addressing the fundamentals of ADS-CFT, where you want to ask, how does the duality work and why does it work? So you want to sort of explore the map between those two sides. And the entanglement entropy has been, in fact, very prominent in both of these programs. Okay, and if you want to use it to understand quantum gravity, well, that would fit in this category, but that's the, so we'll sort of, that's the motivation for looking at entanglement in the ADS-CFT. All right, so in 2000, so I should say, just to stress the point once more, I have told you about the scale radius duality and so forth, and you might think that, well, the mapping between the bulk and the boundary quantities is quite complicated, right? It's very non-local, it scrambles things around quite a lot. And now we want to use this complicated mapping to understand something that's intrinsically also very complicated, namely the entanglement entropy. So you might think that is hopeless, right? You take something that's really complicated but fundamental quantity and you try to express it in the holographic dual, but lo and behold, the answer is very simple. Okay, and this is quite suggestive. We're not yet fully sure what it's suggestive of, but it's very, very remarkable. So Ryu and Takenaki proposed in 2006 that for static configurations, where you can just look at single instant in time, the entanglement entropy of some region on the boundary like this is given by the proper area of a certain surface in the bulk. The surface, which I'll label M, is a minimal surface at this constant time slice. It's this minimal surface that's anchored on this entangling surface dA. Okay, and the entanglement is the area of that in Planck units, quarter of the area of that in Planck units. All right, so that was the proposal. And of course, by now, there's a large body of evidence culminating in this argument by Lefkowitz and Maldacena. And I'm not going to review the proof for you or sort of motivate why it's true, but instead I'll sort of try to explain the implications. Okay, I think that's a more useful thing for this audience to sort of now see what we can do with it. So first observation is that, well, from the gravity standpoint, this is very reminiscent of the black hole entropy formula. So it turns out from black hole mechanics that the entropy of a black hole is given by the horizon, quarter of the horizon area. But here it's much more general. Here the surface is not the horizon of a black hole, but some other minimal surface that actually is non-compact and reaches to the boundary. It hangs into the bulk like this because, as I sketched before, there are large set of distances the closer you get to the boundary, so the surface, to minimize its areas, wants to get away from the boundary as quickly as possible. But it also means that, of course, in the boundary itself, which is infinitely far away, the distances are infinite, and so this area is divergent. That's not a bug, that's a feature, because the entanglement entropy itself in a local quantum field theory is likewise divergent. It has UV divergence is coming from the fact that it has, you know, arbitrarily high, well, small-scale excitations in the field theory. But you can regulate both sides, and the divergences correspond perfectly between the two sides. Okay, so the leading divergence of the entanglement entropy comes from the area of this entangling surface. Okay, so if the region has characteristic size L and the UV cutoff is some quantity delta, then the divergence scales as this in D plus one dimensional bulk, so D dimensional boundary, so D minus one dimensional space on the boundary, the area of the entangling surface scales as length the D minus two. And there might be subleading divergences that depend on the geometry of this surface, but eventually once you get to the finite terms, these are universal. And you can regulate the quantity by, for example, taking a computing this in vacuum and in the state you're interested in and subtracting the two and so forth. So the divergences correspond nicely and the finite quantities are correspond nicely. All right, but I should pause at this point to sort of explain one point that sort of sometimes is sometimes the language between the communities does not quite correspond, which is what we mean by area law and volume law. There has been much debate on areas laws and volume law. The area law just follows the fact that the divergent part scales with the area, the dominant part, comes from this point that the surface comes up to the boundary. So in any local field theory, you're sort of guaranteed, when it has this holographic dual, you're guaranteed that you have a leading divergence scaling with the area, simply from the geometry. On the other hand, if you heat up the system, right, then you have in the bulk dual, you form a black hole. And it's a simple fact to show that for a static black hole, minimal surfaces are repelled from the horizon. The minimal surfaces don't want to penetrate an event horizon of a black hole. And so what happens is that in this cartoon I have way too many lines, but I didn't have time to replot this. So there are different dimension surfaces, but all of them, no matter what dimensionality you take, get repelled by this horizon. So if you push the black hole up by heating up the system more, or take a longer interval here, you find that the finite part now of the entanglement entropy scales mostly with the volume of this full region that you're interested in, not just the area was the infinite divergence, and the volume is this finite piece. All right. So that was all nice and well, but I said that the Ryu Takanagi prescription was for static configurations, where you're just looking at one instant in time. But often we're interested, of course, in fully time-dependent situations, and one nice thing about the entanglement entropy is that it's a quantity that is well-defined for arbitrarily strong time dependence, unlike the thermal entropy, for example, where you need to be in local equilibrium. So we want a more robust prescription for how to understand this time-dependent entanglement entropy in holography. All right, and the problem with just naively extending the Ryota-Kanagi prescription directly is that, well, first of all, in a Lorentzian geometry, you can decrease an area of a surface simply by replink it up and down in time. So here's the soup can picture. So we're now, the spatial slice was this slice here. Here's our boundary region, and the minimal surface is this surface like this. If you wiggle it up and down, its area can decrease, so you don't have a minimal area surface anymore. The other problem is that when you have a time-dependent background, constant time slice doesn't have any meaning anymore. It's just a coordinate specification, and you could have chosen some other coordinates. Okay, so the constant time slice now doesn't make any, isn't anything special. All right, so we want to covariantize this prescription. And indeed, this is quite easy to do. We have done that following Ryota-Kanagi's paper just a year later. And the most obvious generalization, which is the one that seems to work, is that this minimal surface at a constant time gets generalized to simply an extremal surface in the full bulk. Okay, an extremal surface is a surface that is an extremum of the area function. Okay, so it's a the three-dimensional bulk would the extremal surface in a three-dimensional bulk would be just a space-like geodesic. Okay, so this is just a generalization of a space-like geodesic to a codimension two surface. It's always a codimension two surface. So in three dimensions, that would be one-dimensional geodesic. All right, so the what we call the HRT prescription is that the entanglement entropy of a given region in the boundary is given by the area, again, quarter of the area in Planck units, of this extremal surface. All right, so the picture is pretty much the same. Oh, and I should say, well, first of all, it's from the class that's anchored on these on the entangling surface here. It also has this requirement that I'll get back to later, that it has to be homologous. Okay, I'll get to that in a second. And if you have several such extremal surfaces that doesn't happen in pure radius, but can easily happen in some, you know, excited states and some other geometries in the bulk, then you take the smallest area one. All right, so you can equivalently express the extremal surface in various other ways. Okay, you can think, you can express it as one where if you send off light rays away from it, perpendicularly away from it, the areas along the light fronts don't change initially. They don't start expanding or contracting as they go away from the surface. Okay, that's what's called a null. The null expansion is zero. Or you can sort of think of it in this maximum construction by taking some slice, any spatial slice through the bulk, taking a minimal area surface on that, on a spatial slice it's well defined, and then maximizing over all possible slices. Okay, that's useful for some proofs, but conceptually it's a bit more complicated than the extremal surface. In any case, this prescription gives a well-defined quantity that's robustly well-defined in any arbitrarily time-dependent situation, so it's as equally well-defined as, you know, it is in the field theory. But unfortunately, we can't now use the convenient Euclidean techniques that we could have used for the, you know, proving the Ryota-Kanagi prescription for the static situation, and we can't use this minimization for the various proofs. Okay, so this is a bit harder prescription to deal with, but it's much more general, and it's not as hard as you might fear. So let's see some of the uses of the geometry. Let's start with the easy properties that are sort of manifest from this holographic prescription. Well, so first of all, if you have a pure state, the entanglement entropy of any given subset is the same as the entanglement entropy of its complement. So here we take any region A. This is the complement of the region A. This is, again, a Poincaré disk sort of picture. And the extremal surface for pure states is just something that's the same for both of them. Okay, so it's manifestly true. It's also manifestly positive because it's area of some surface. Now, a more interesting relation is the subadditivity. If you take two two regions, A1 and A2, the sum of the entanglement entropies of them is always bigger than the entanglement entropy of the union. Again, in the bulk, that comes simply because you have all this extra divergences already, so that's sort of manifestly true. But it implies the positivity of mutual information, which is the difference between the two sides. The more complicated relation is, in fact, the strong subadditivity. It's stronger because it takes this one and says that the entanglement of entropy of the sum of the entanglement entropies of two intervals is bigger not just than the entanglement entropy of the union, but that it's bigger than the sum of the entanglement entropy of the union and the intersection. Okay, so in the bulk, the union is this purple, is represented by the area of this purple curve. The intersection is this one. There are two versions of subadditivity. You can also take it as this relation where these surfaces are the corresponding ones. And there the proof, well, for static situations, is very, very simple. It's beautiful sort of one-line proof that Matt and Tadashi wrote soon after the correspondence. So the proof goes as follows. So take the left-hand side, okay, that's these two surfaces, and split up the surfaces in this fashion, as this surface plus this surface area, and now deform those two surfaces to be the actual minimal surfaces corresponding to the intersection and the union. Because these ones are the minimal surfaces, they're surely larger, sorry, they're surely smaller than these ones, which are the same as this. So that proves strong subadditivity. And you can prove the other relation similarly. In fact, you can also prove the relation that's called the monogamy of mutual information, which pertains if you have three systems. So I have written it slightly different notation than this, but well, Matt might talk a bit more about that later. But the interesting point about the monogamy is that that need not hold for generic quantum systems, whereas the strong subadditivity does have to hold. It's a property of the von Neumann entropy. This one isn't, but nevertheless, in the holography, this has the same, this is proved essentially in the same way. Now, for static situation, that's very, very easy. For time-dependent situation, it's a bit harder, but you can still do it. Okay, so this has been done by Aaron Wall a few years ago, and you can it uses properties of null geodesics and certain energy conditions, but it's much, much easier than doing it directly in the field theory. All right, now a more complicated relation on entanglement entropy is the so-called Arakelyi inequality. Okay, so if you have a pure state entanglement entropy of some region A is the same as its complement, but in general, if you have some mixed state, they're not the same. Okay, and in the holographic case, you can see it from this homology constraint. So let's take a thermal state that's not a pure state, and in the bulk, that corresponds to having an eternal black hole, a static eternal black hole. The homology constraint tells you that if you take a region, let's say this large region like this, you can either take an extremal surface that goes around the black hole on the same side as your boundary region, or you can take actually a set of surfaces, one that wraps the black hole, that actually is a minimal surface, and one that's on the other side that would have been homologous to A complement. But what you cannot do is just take that one without anything else. You can't just take this because that would not satisfy the homology constraint. It would not satisfy the constraint that there's some interpolating codimension one slice whose only boundaries are the extremal surface and the boundary region. Because in the black hole geometry, what actually happens is that you have the black hole is just a Einstein-Rosen bridge to another asymptotic region, that's this one, and so some interpolation surface would leak out to the other side. So it would have other boundaries. Sorry? Okay. All right, so it turns out that despite them not being equal, their difference is bounded by the total entropy of the full system. That's the Arakelyi inequality. And if you look at these extremal surfaces in a, let's say, three-dimensional black hole background, the sort of so-called BTC black hole, they're just spatial geodesics, you might have naively thought that if you just take the area of the length of the sort of spatial geodesics, you get this expression that Calabrese and Cardi had computed for the planar case long, long ago. But what happens is that if you look at this difference of entanglement entropy of a region and its complement, it actually diverges. So it does not satisfy Araki-Leib inequality. So what, however, you need to do, the resolution, okay, I'll take a few more minutes and then, all right, the resolution is that you need to take the smallest area one. So in fact, you end up using the ones that went on the other side of the black hole and the black hole itself. Okay, so this is the relation that you get for large enough region, large enough A, and that gives rise to this, what we call the entanglement plateaus. So at some point, if you have large enough region, its entanglement entropy is given by the complement entanglement entropy plus the total entropy, which is the entropy of the black hole, independently of increasing the size here. Okay, so that's the plateau. And it tells you that the entanglement structure now splits very cleanly into these two different pieces. Okay, the ones that are mock up the thermal correlations and the ones that are the quantum correlations with the rest of the system. All right, now you can also use entanglement entropy prescription for studying dynamics. All right, so for example, you can look at a quantum quench. Now I'm going to breeze through this very quickly because I'm out of time. So you can, So you can start, so I want to deform the Hamiltonian at some point in time and watch the system. I start with a ground state, I deform the Hamiltonian, and I want to watch the system evolve. This is called the global quench, if I make my deformation homogeneous. And I want to study this on the other, on the dual side. So in the field theory, in the gravity side, you start with pure radius, you create some disturbance at, say, time equal to zero, okay, so by inserting in some local operators all over the boundary like this. Now in the bulk, you're creating some disturbance that's like a shell of matter, of energy that falls in, that collapses. And if you back react it, it forms a black hole. So this is the horizon of the black hole, which stretches to here. If you put in more energy to start with, you collapse a bigger black hole. And to study how the system thermalizes, you can look at the entanglement entropy corresponding to fixed size region as you vary the time. Okay, so so you have rather exotic types of extremal surfaces, so they can penetrate inside the black hole no matter how late they start, and they can have, even in the late time black hole, can be very bizarrely sort of folded around the black hole, in fact, arbitrarily many times. But so you might think it's very complicated quantity, this entanglement entropy varied in time, but actually, despite all that complication, despite both of these, it seems that the minimality is the thing that saves you, and you get a very nice sort of time dependence curves. You have a monotonic, continuous entanglement entropy varied in time. And we might hear more about it in Hong's talk. But I want to say that a priori, this wasn't necessarily guaranteed to happen. Now, the thing I really wanted to tell you about is, you know, you might be scared of by these complicated GR constructs, but I want to sort of make the point that those are very powerful. And instead of looking at, you know, very highly symmetric spacetimes where you can actually do explicit calculations, there's an advantage, or there's a use of looking at completely general spacetimes, time-dependent, you know, no symmetries, where you can't do explicit calculations, but you have very powerful theorems in general relativity that you can utilize to sort of motivate your constructs. If you use a highly symmetric situation, you might not distinguish, you know, different constructs might coincide, and it's hard to distinguish them. Whereas if you look at generic case, you can distinguish them. Okay, so this is quite powerful, and you can, for example, ask, you know, what is the dual of the reduced density matrix? And you might say, well, if it's a nice thing in the bulk, a nice natural covariant quantity, such as some causal set, is defined, is bounded by certain null geodesics, null congruences, and there are two types of options. Either you can start from the boundary, you can send in null geodesics from the boundary, okay, so you pick a region A, you pick its domain of dependence, so that's the region on the boundary that's determined by initial conditions on A, so determined by the reduced density matrix, and then you can construct a causal set that's causally connected to this region, both in past and future, or you can start from the bulk, there a natural starting point is the extremal surface, and you can send in null geodesics from that outward to the boundary, and that bounds what we call the entanglement wedge, which is the region that's space-like separated from this extremal surface. So just to orient you pictorially, in pure ADS, both of these coincide, they would look like this, so this is the boundary region, this would be the extremal surface, and if you shoot null geodesics, they just look like this. But in general, the entanglement wedge and causal wedge are different constructs. So the point that even though they're bounded by null geodesics, the difference between them is where you're starting the null geodesics from. And just to illustrate that, here I have drawn a causal wedge and entanglement wedge in slightly different situations, where you can see, however, an interesting feature that's important from the GR perspective, which is that geodesics are attracted due to gravity and can cross each other. Okay, they don't go parallel; they're attracted a bit and they cross over. Okay, the caustic can cross over, and this crossover seam is in different points depending on where you start. So for the causal wedge, now here is a causal wedge for a black hole, this crossover seam is sort of down, has this structure, whereas if you have an entanglement wedge, you start the geodesics from here going up, they can cross at the top. All right, so that motivates, there's a simple reason for why these two constructs are different. This guy is its own domain of dependence in the bulk. This guy is not. This guy is included in its domain of dependence, but is not its domain of dependence. All right. So these covariant constructs then allow us to prove very nicely that, well, first of all, the causal wedge is contained in the entanglement wedge. Okay, I'll take a few moments. Or equivalently, the extremal surface has to lie in what we call the causal shadow, and that has lots of useful consequences. It means that this prescription, this HRT prescription, is consistent with causality. It implies these entanglement plateaus for any generic collapsed black hole. It's the entanglement wedge, which is a natural dual of the reduced density matrix, can reach way into a black hole, and so forth. All right, now let's see. Okay, so the entanglement entropy has various curious features. The extremal surface can be very complicated. All right, I'll get back to that in question session if you guys ask. On the one hand, entanglement entropy seems too local. You have very sharply defined a surface in the boundary and very sharply defined surface in the bulk. Okay, but that means that you can recover the bulk metric from knowing the set of these entanglement entropies. But at the same time, entanglement entropy seems also too non-local, in the sense that this minimality condition and homology are sensitive to regions which are arbitrarily far away. So just to illustrate that point, if you collapse to a black hole and you might think that the black hole has settled down after a long time, the entanglement entropy, however, does know about this collapse, in that this is always a pure state, no matter how long ago you collapsed a black hole. So that's an important lesson. The entanglement entropy has this very fine-grained, non-local information that it's carrying. All right, so I'll just summarize that holography conveniently geometrizes entanglement, and there's intriguing questions about that, which I'll leave for you to ask if you want to. The general covariance is a very powerful guiding principle, And again, you can ask various questions about it. And the big question is, what is actually the relation between gravity and or space-time and entanglement? Okay, so sorry for running over time, and let me stop there. We have interesting discuss. Let me just go
okay,
back.
So we have 10 minutes time for questions.
So I've heard this phrase a lot, when a theory has a holographic dual. My question is, when does a theory have a holographic dual?
Very good question. Okay, so we don't know the full answer to that, but we know that it has to be, it has to have large central charge, first of all. But that by itself, so here it was the large N in the example that I gave, but also it has to be something that has only a few sort of low-lying excitations and a gap, a large gap between them. Okay, so that's one sort of restriction, one part of the criterion, but we don't really know fully whether, so there has been nice work by Joe Polchinski and friends of sort of formulating that criterion. There's been lots of subsequent discussions, but I think it's fair to say we can't say, this is, if you meet these criteria, you're guaranteed to always have a holographic dual, and if you don't meet them, you can't have a holographic dual.
More questions?
I guess I'm trying to get some intuition about the time-dependent minimal surface.
So good.
How does it? Can you get some intuition? Like, what is the perturbation that makes it go into, be time-dependent, and somehow then it, this minimal surface end? It's still a co-dimension.
Right. So
to object.
Let me just find this picture. All right, so here, one more. All right, so here would be the regions at different times that you can specify, and to each of those, there's a extremal surface.
Right.
The extremal surface in here would just go straight across. But if you take an extremal surface here, it will fill the black hole. So this thing is going around the, sort of it will be something that goes around the black hole. For these regions in between, the extremal surface would come, see this collapsing shell and go into the past. So for example, it would do something like this. Okay, it comes, it's anchored on the boundary region. It comes in, it feels the black hole, sort of attraction of the black hole, and it's sort of can't penetrate initially, sort of well out here, but it's, if you look at what's a local extremum of the area function, it can look like this. Okay, so as you vary the time of this where you put your boundary region, the shape of the extremal surface varies if the bulk geometry varies.
But it sort of traces out a sheet then, space-time.
Yes, if you take the set of all extremal surfaces as you take them later and later in time, it traces out some.
It might fluctuate from some valley, from some.
Indeed, and it's
to something else.
Indeed. And it need not be a nice, simple, time-like surface in general.
Okay.
All right, but depending on the geometry, but its area is something that actually is very nice. Its area is something that grew monotonically like this.
So, Veronica, all of the entanglement wedges that you talk about mm-hmm. all reach out to the boundary.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought about trying to take differences between things that would isolate just a local region in the bulk and sort of have all the stuff out near the boundary canceling out?
Okay, so certainly it ends on the domain of dependence of your boundary region. So the ending point, maybe I should go to this picture with the causal wedge and entanglement wedge just to illustrate the difference. Okay, so for example, here it goes out, and then these guys cross over and caustic, and then it ends on this. So you could certainly, for example, take a causal wedge of this. It would not penetrate quite as far, but at the boundary it would penetrate to the same, it would be bounded on the same region. So you could certainly take, you know, the difference, if you want, between the causal wedge and the entanglement wedge. Or you could also take a set that Mark van Ramsdonk and company considered, which is the set of all extremal surfaces which are anchored within this boundary domain of dependence, which is actually smaller than this entanglement wedge generically. Whenever you have these corners, the extremal surface doesn't get into the corners. So you could take that difference, which is a smaller difference than the one between the causal wedge and entanglement wedge. And those differences are intriguing in terms of where you can use given techniques of holographic reconstruction of the bulk metric. Of course, we know how to do it easily in the causal wedge, but we don't know how to do it in this region between the causal wedge and the entanglement wedge.
You don't know how to do it in
that yet.
Okay, thank you.
So there is more time for questions.
I think there was one in the back. Somewhere, did you have? Okay.
Wait a second, please.
Maybe it's the same question as what you just said. So, like, if I think in terms of the representing the bulk operators as the boundary operators, what's the difference between inside the causal wedge and outside the causal wedge, but inside the entanglement wedge? Like, is the statement that the operators outside the causal wedge cannot be written as boundary operators in that region, or?
We don't know. Oh. The statement is that there is a nice prescription by Lokabat-Lifshitz, Hamilton-type prescription of reconstructing a local bulk operator inside the causal wedge in terms of some set of local boundary operators as some integral over those on the boundary. And there isn't such a prescription for points in the entanglement wedge. It might require, because the entanglement wedge can reach so far out of causal contact from the boundary region, right? It's not going to be accessible by any sort of null geodesic, for example, between the far end of the entanglement wedge and the domain of dependence of your boundary region. There won't be this type of reconstruction. You might need some non-local operators, for example, to do it, or something else. Okay, so the motivation, however, that the reduced density matrix should know about the spacetime inside the entanglement wedge comes from this expectation that, well, it certainly knows about the entanglement entropy. The entanglement entropy is given by the area of the extremal surface, which is the rim of the entanglement wedge. And it also should know the reduced density matrix of all smaller subregion entanglement entropies. So that sort of populates the areas of all these extremal surfaces reaching within this region. Then if you know the bulk, you know, dynamics, you could evolve and find the spacetime inside the entire entanglement wedge if those, you know, extremal surfaces have populated at least this region. Okay, that frequently happens. It's not guaranteed to happen, but it frequently happens. Okay, so we know that the density matrix at least contains some information from outside the causal wedge, but it would be very interesting and very nice to figure out an explicit reconstruction. Okay, so the quantum gravity workshop has been sort of partly, you know, focused on that or discussing that, but so far we don't have the answer. We think it works, yeah. We think it works, but well, you guys have had a nice reconstruction that in toy models of this error correction context.
Yeah, so maybe you said this and I didn't catch it, but in the scenario where you start in a vacuum and you perturb your quantum field theory enough to just form a black hole,
yeah.
How do you get irreversibility? Because, you know, your black hole forms, you get some, now you have a thermal field theory, but eventually it will evaporate, and then it will, so black hole eventually evaporate, and then your quantum field theory will go back to zero temperature?
Okay, so now it sort of depends, you know, whether you have infinite, strictly speaking, infinite, you know, number of degrees of freedom or finite. If you have finite n, okay, you have some finite entropy, then there's a Poincaré recurrence where in the bulk you might have a black hole, but at some point, you know, after exponentially long time, exponential in entropy, the thing, the system becomes back to whatever it was. Okay, that's like, you know, having Poincaré recurrence of, you know, any thermodynamic finite sort of system of having a, you know, gas in this room or whatever. So that will happen quantum mechanically.
Right.
Classically, the entropy is infinite. Okay, so it never happens.
You're saying
classically, the black hole also
is a continuum or something. If I don't put a lattice on my field theory, or
No. So it's, you don't need to. So this is independent of latticizing the system. This is just the rank of the gauge group of your field theory. It's a continuum field theory.
About N. Okay, of SUN.
But if you have infinite n, then the system really is classical. The black hole doesn't evaporate, doesn't Poincaré recur, and so forth. So it's sort of, the answer depends a bit more on the details of the specification of the question. Are you sort of working at some finite h bar, you know? Or
yeah,
are you really taking the
some finite n? Let's say you're not.
Right. So in that case, in that case, you have both. Well, you have Hawking evaporation going on, but the Hawking quanta, Hawking quanta sort of get bounced off from the boundary and fall back in. So you have some equilibrium state. But after this exponentially long time, you have this Poincaré recurrence.
Okay, so let's continue the discussion over the coffee break. So we'll make a break now until 10:30. And actually, I don't know where is the break, so where is going to be.